are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal, and we'll be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. Join the team.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
I'm Eddie Zane.
And I'm Helen Zia.
And we're on Hard Knock Radio.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to have a discussion about meritocracy. What does it mean? I want to talk about the question that is being raised as to whether or not, quote-unquote, Americans are prepared to do the work that's in front of them. This quote came out maybe about a month ago, and it's from Vivek Ramaswamy. And it goes like this. The reason top techie companies often hire foreign-born and first-generation engineers over Native Americans isn't because of an innate American IQ deficit, a lazy and wrong explanation. A key part of it comes down to the C word, culture. Tough questions demand tough answers, and if we're really serious about fixing the problem, we have to confront the truth. Our American culture has venerated mediocrity over excellence for way too long, at least since the 90s and likely longer. That doesn't start in college, it starts young. A culture that celebrates the prom queen over the math Olympiad champ or the jock over the valedictorian will not produce the best engineers. A culture that venerates Corey from The Boy Meets World or Zack and Slater over Skeech in Saved by the Bell or Stefan over Steve Urkel in Family Matters will not produce the best engineers. Fact, I know multiple sets of immigrant parents in the 90s who actively limited how much their kids could watch those TV shows precisely because they promoted mediocrity. And their kids went on to become wildly successful STEM graduates. And I'll continue here. More movies like Whiplash, fewer reruns of Friends, more math tutoring, fewer sleepovers, more weekend science competitions, fewer Saturday morning cartoons, more books, less TV, more creating, less chilling, more extracurricular, less hanging out at the mall. Most normal American parents look skeptically at those kind of parents. More normal American kids view such of those kind of kids with scorn. If you grow up aspiring to normalcy, normalcy is what you will achieve. And he goes on and on, but I think you get the point. I have two guests here who are educators on the front line. Both hold court by themselves. I'm glad to have both of them on. Out of Chicago, we have David Stavall, and we have here in Oakland, Hadari Davis. I wanted to really have you both on to talk about this because we all came up at a time where that speech that Vivek Ramaswamy said, I've heard that before, and I heard it in my household. My parents demanded A's from us. Our parents are like, you're not going to be like these kids next door. Turn that TV off. I expect nothing but the best. We're not going to be mediocre. And I suspect that you guys have also had similar type of conversations. And as educators, I suspect you also have pushed your kids, you know, whether it's Young Gifted or Black or whether the work that you do in Chicago, Dave, I think you push your kids for excellence. Hearing this speech in the context of Trump's administration getting ready to take hold and this guy being a part of it, knowing that they're anti-Black, anti-immigrant, knowing that they have been firmly behind white supremacy and policies related to that, makes it a very interesting and scary type of conversation. And I'll close with this. The people that are upset are the MAGA folks, the folks that were voting for Donald Trump and saying, the reason why we can't get ahead is because of these Black people. The reason why we need to dismantle diversity, education, and inclusion is because Black people are getting an unfair advantage and people need to get on their merit, you know, get in on their merit. The problem is now you have Asians and East Indians in particular who are getting in on that very merit. And now these very same white folks that wanted to dismantle these programs looking at us now want some sort of adjustment because they can't compete with the very people that are now serving the Trump administration, demanding that they bring in foreign help because Americans are just mediocre and can't really hack it. So there's layers and levels to this, and I think you are the two people to help us get through it. I want to start with you, Dave. In Chicago, ground zero, you hear this sort of stuff. What's the first thing that comes to your mind, and how do you start to unpack some of it?
Yeah, the first, and again, thanks so much for having me on. I think the first thing that comes up, that this is a conversation that is about capitalism with a shroud of race, right? So this is a broader conversation about capitalism and how the United States can advance itself in terms of holding on to the power that is slowly seeing slip from its grips. And I think we have to be very clear about this. And this is an older argument, right? So if we go back to William Bennett in the 80s under the Reagan administration, when you have the first kind of broad-based policy on Nation at Risk, you know, it's this thing around aspiration, but also a false narrative. And I think the false narrative becomes important to lay out. In The Nation at Risk in 1983, William Bennett claimed that the United States needs to return itself to prominence on the world stage. The problem with that was when you look at test scores and any types of these arbitrary evaluations, quote unquote, around a performance, they were rooted in a false narrative. The United States has never been first, right? The United States actually has never been higher than 23rd, right? So this thing around trying to put folks in this mix. And then the other part of that is you have to name a boogeyman. We're not doing this because of this, as you pointed out in your earlier comments. And I think we have to really think about the levels and layers in relationship to what stands for people being able to develop clarity and to self-determine. That's very different from this idea of excellence and getting some high-paying gig where you may be further exploited, where it's a different thing to say if you have determined what it is that you want to do, what supports you educationally in that self-determination. And I think Ravek's points are back to that old trope where there's a sprinkling of truth in some of that in terms of you have to be able to shut off a lot of this world in terms of its social media, in terms of its distractions. And then that's a way to now figure out how to self-determine. But the narrative that he's actually using is this thing around admonition. See, this is the problem with y'all. interposed to saying we have a much larger problem here that we have to now think about in relationship to capitalism in its last stages and the ways in which we understand learning. And I think when you get into that conversation, it's very different from this kind of weaponizing of young people always on TikTok doing dances or what have you and not paying attention to the real world. I think that is a narrative that is not accurate in terms of what folks have been denied in terms of learning opportunities.
And that is why we have David Stavall here. Took us all the way back to the days of William Bennett, and I'm glad you framed it that way. Hadari, I want to get you in here, but I also want to build on this notion. Again, I started off by saying, I've heard this speech before, and I've heard it from my parents, and I've heard it from other parents that demanded we have, you know, that we do our best. It was couched in, we have to be twice as good in order to get ahead. I think that attracts people to a certain degree, and it shouldn't be foreign to a lot of us. And everything that Dave Stavall says is spot on. It's something, I agree, it's weaponized. It's couched a certain way, but there's a larger agenda. But I want to come back to those remarks and get your take on it as an educator.
Yeah, I think the tapestry is being widened. I think the amount of cultures or communities that are talked about in the context of American education is broadened when people like Vivek Ramaswamy talk about the culture of America. You know, this conversation used to be black and white, and it's become so much more inclusive of a variety of different voices and communities and perspectives. And the election ran kind of on this black and white trope, those people and us. And after the election is over, you know, they finding out that us is a little more diverse than they thought. You know, they were clear on the those people part, but they weren't quite as clear on the us part. And now they're finding out that us includes Vivek Ramaswamy and other folks getting these special visas so that they can come to the country. And, you know, you can be anti-immigrant when you're being told that the immigrants are rapists and murderers. But when you're told that the immigrants are actually the ones that are propping up the system, that are maintaining the technology that you've become dependent on, maintaining social media, maintaining even government itself or the financing of government, then it kind of shifts the way people think about the role of immigrants or non-Native Americans in their contribution to what is the United States of America. And Dave is right. Like, America is 125th in literacy in the world. Like, we're not turning out the highest level of education, and our education system is plagued by debt and deficit and kind of a lack of control. We have rogue school boards who are being manipulated by people who want to remove books and remove tech. None of this leads to excellence. Like, that is the drive to mediocrity. When you no longer want to challenge the students, when you no longer want them to have to confront different truths, when you're removing histories and removing cultural experiences from the actual curriculum itself, then it narrows education and it narrows people's understanding of education. And that's going to limit success on multiple levels, including the ability to work beside someone who's not like you, doesn't come from where you come from, has a different experience, et cetera. I think it's also great that you mentioned that we've heard this speech before. This is Obama's speech to Black America a couple of different times. You know, I've heard this speech from the President of the United States saying we need to stop, you know, getting caught up in the drama of these culture wars, this rap culture, and this, you know, culture of not living up to our best potential. Like, we've heard this before. This is a common thing for, especially for African American people. We're constantly told that we need to work harder, that we're not doing enough, that it's going to, you know, 10 times. I've heard 10 times. You said we need to work twice as hard. Shoot, I've heard 10 times harder and be 10 times better just to get the same thing. So, you know, I think it's an interesting moment to be having this conversation as the government shifts to a more authoritarian ruler, a more somebody who really wants to transform the way we understand what we understand America to be and who we understand Americans to be. But I don't find it shocking. I don't find any of what he said shocking or even out of pocket, because it's just a conversation that we've heard before. It's not new. It's not fresh. What would be fresh is to talk about how the education system needs to be transformed. I think it's ironic that the same people who get rich off of AI and social media and et cetera are now the ones preaching about how detrimental it is to the literacy or education of Americans. I think that's hilarious. That's hilarious. But if we are going to prioritize and we are going to look at education as something that's important and that's powerful, then we need to commit ourselves to visions of what it's going to take for us to achieve the future that we want. You know, a lot of our education system is about the past and about the present. A lot of our young people are being prepared for a present that they don't understand and a future that they can't even see. And so we need to have serious conversations in this country about what is the direction that the country is going in and what will it take in terms of education for the American people, specifically these young people, to be prepared for what's coming. Unfortunately, right. It doesn't feel like the system is preparing the young people for even the now, much less for tomorrow.
Both of you all are educators. That's the voice of Hadari Davis. And so quite naturally, we're talking about young people. But when I heard this or read this speech and, you know, heard them kind of talk, I realized that there's a heck of a lot of adults that fall into this category as well. They are waking up and finding out, to Dave's point, that, or I think you said that there's been an expansion. And that expansion is that if there's mediocrity and you think it's black and brown folks, well, guess what? It's a lot of you white folks who ran with the MAGA thing, and it's a lot of people who got behind that are woefully mediocre. In fact, the fact that you got behind some of these policies and didn't see the game that was being played might be an indication of that. And I'm sure somebody who's smarter, as these folks say they are, looked at it and said, man, we ran game on this whole group of people. Man, they're dumb. And we'll even tell them they're dumb, and they will still stand behind us. I want to lay that out, but I also want to point out something else, and Dave, get your comments on this. The narrative of black and brown folks, black folks in particular, not working hard. You know, we, as Hadari said, Obama gave this speech, he went to Morehouse, the best of the best, and gave that speech, and people dragged him through the mud. Like, how are you going to stand in front of Morehouse and tell them to pull their pants up? Their pants are already up. They're the best of the best. But that sort of speech seems to be detached from the reality. And you talk about it as an educator. Many of our folks are very innovative, very smart, try their best, work hard. And if they don't succeed, a lot of times it has more to do, which you pointed out, with lack of resources than it does with, you know, lack of drive.
Well, I think the thing that becomes important, and Hadari spoke to it, is this thing around the distraction. Right, the distraction is individualism, right? So you can create, pick a couple of instances and say, see, here's what's wrong with folks, right? You don't want to do XXX. But I always think about that in terms of, we never talk about structural barriers, right? We always talk about individual barriers, what the individual is not willing to do. But, you know, I always push this back, and I think I've made this point on the show. Here in Chicago, we have 100 schools that do not have libraries. Let's just put that in context, right?
100 schools?
100. Now, if we put that in context, if you have 100 schools that do not have libraries, right, a quintessential resource for young people to develop inquiry, right? So when you talk about innovation, innovation is fueled by your ability to ask questions. So now, if you don't have the key component in developing your capacity to ask questions, then we have a structural problem. Because in those same communities, those are the ones that are the most housing insecure, healthcare insecure, that have the least access to living wage employment, and are the most surveilled by law enforcement. So we have to put that in context. So when we talk about here's this thing or these unmotivated young folks, the question is always, well, what have we put to them that they can engage? What mechanisms do we have that they can actually speak to their interests and we can support them with resources for them to pursue their interests? And this question, when you have this kind of, and everything is so hyperbolic, because now when I may say this in public, oh, that's coddling young folks. And my response is, look, man, if I'm in a space and I don't have the building blocks for me to even conceptualize what education could potentially look like, then what are we doing? How do we have that expectation on a young person when they may not know themselves nor have the resources to even pursue it? So now we have to think about what that means. And then, you know, there's layers to that, right? Because now we talk about, you know, Black and brown youth who are in these kind of high-end burbs. They may not be from high-income families, but they're in these burbs that are heavily resourced. But even in those spaces, we can still see the isolation, right? We can look at the suspension rates. We can look at the expulsion rates. We can look at who's in what classes, whether it be honors, AP, or what have you, International Baccalaureate, however they frame it. So now we still have to address this isolation. And individualism puts us in that distraction. Oh, that's the STEM, they don't want to work, right? They don't want to pursue this. They don't want it. What it's really saying to folks, and I think it's important for us to just be honest about this, they are saying that young people are not willing to compromise and sacrifice and denigrate themselves and dehumanize themselves for something that someone has put in front of them as a false reward, right? And I think when we engage that and we think about when we are asking young people to dehumanize themselves, right? To no longer think of themselves as worthy of anything, and what expectation do we have around learning? And I think that's a different question, but also a tougher question, because now right. We have to think about those structural issues that limit people's capacity to even engage.
And as you're talking, Dave Savelle, I'm thinking of the gaslighting that goes on. I can hear you saying what you're saying, and somebody who's making $100,000 or six figures sitting on a TV station, you know, has a nice home and got that job because they didn't get it through merit, but they knew somebody who knew somebody that was like, come on down here to the studio and get your job, right? Who would say, Dave, that sounds like excuse making, because when I was your age, you know, I walked to school in the snow for 15 miles and my grandfather came over here from Poland and he put in work, and look at where he's at, and I don't understand, you know, why you're able to do it. This is the Ramaswamy thing, because mm-hmm. he's just getting here in the 90s and looking around and it's going, I don't understand. And that overlooks the fact that you might have been part of the 1% that was able to leave India and you came here with some things intact, you know, ignoring the systemic barriers that, you know, impact 90% of the country that you come from. You see what I'm saying? So I get that. But there's two conversations going on simultaneously. There's a middle class conversation that, you know, that comes from the Obama types, that are looking and saying, Dave, that sounds like excuse making. These kids just need to work harder. And then there's white folks who are mediocre in their own right, who are blaming you for their own mediocrity. And then there's this orchestration from the top, which is really gaslighting everybody, saying at the end of the day, there's only going to be a finite number of jobs that are going to pay folks this tech money, even though we're a trillion-dollar company. It's only going to be a finite number, and it ain't going to be you, the MAGA crowd that voted for Trump. Y'all ain't getting those jobs. And, you know, certainly black folks ain't getting the job because we're dismantling DEI, and the only way they think you get it is through that. And so I think there's going to be a reckoning with people confused as to what is going on. I don't think we'll be confused because we're already used to that sort of craziness, but I think there's a whole lot of other folks that are waking up, as you're seeing, saying, let's change the rules. Let's, you know, let's make sure that there's a path for us to get to these jobs. It's like, didn't we just dismantle that? Weren't we trying to make sure that people who had these structures in front of them could get a path to that? Now you want to change the rules. And to me, on one hand, it's sad, but it's also funny. You know, I want to double down and kind of troll those folks, you know, because I got my degrees and got my A pluses, and you are mediocre, is what I want to say to a lot of folks who are complaining. At the same time, you can't do that because we see the structural damage that is in our own communities that need to be fixed. So it's complex. Hadar, your thoughts on
that? Yeah, I think Dave talking about the institution is really important. It's a key, mm-hmm. not only to understanding the limitations of the society at large, but also limitations on the future. Like, for example, we know that all the schools in the city of Oakland have lead in the water. We know all of them, not some of them. All the schools in Oakland have lead in the water. There's lead in the soil of Oakland. So how do you overcome that to get excellence on your math score or on your language art score when you've been poisoned by the water for decades? So if you don't address the institutional inequity, it's impossible to talk about these kind of broader notions of where we stand, where people in our community stand, where young people stand. If you can't give them clean water and actual libraries with books inside and teachers that are trained and classrooms that are not overcrowded, you know, and textbooks that are accurate, and materials that are on par with the materials that other people have to do advanced technology, advanced computing, to learn how to use algorithms, et cetera. Like, we can't even get Wi-Fi in all these schools, in all these neighborhoods, or in all these communities. So it doesn't really fall on the kids or the families or the culture or who's watching too much TV. Like, if we don't dig up the lead pipes and make sure that there's clean water funneled into these communities, then it's impossible for then that other conversation is almost irrelevant. It's an irrelevant conversation. I think, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy wasn't drinking lead-laced water, and neither were these other people who immigrated to the United States and took advantage of all the quote-unquote opportunities to rise to the level of their merit. It's like they were not having to overcome the types of things that people in our communities have to overcome to even get to the front door, just to get to the front door.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Hadari. You come from a line of educators. Mom's an educator. You're an educator. Wife, the whole nine. When you're in the classroom with your kids, knowing that there's lead in the water, there's all these systemic challenges, you still have managed to produce a lot of excellence. How have you been able to make that happen? And I think that's important because people have tried. We don't celebrate that. We don't look at the Lord's work, if you say, that you and others have done to achieve in spite of. Certainly, you just don't tell the. Certainly, you don't give them a pass and say, "I'm going to excuse you not being able to do your best." I've seen you pull the best out of folks. So how do you do that, knowing that people want you to keep doing that miracle work without the resources? I know that needs to be challenged, but what do you say to these folks when you know, when they're in those classrooms with lead in the water.
I say we have generations of educators and families and communities that have had to overcome incredible obstacles just to get to the baseline. I'm saying that we had to be woke. We had to be woke about the water. If we weren't woke about what was in the water, our kids would be drinking out of a water fountain. Our kids would be showering in lead water. So you have to be woke enough about the water to turn the tap off, to not use that water to cook your food, to not feed that water to your children. That's one example, but the water is just a metaphor. It's a metaphor for a lot of different things that we kind of feed our children without a real understanding of the impact that these things have on their children long term, because the lead doesn't go away, and neither does the poison pill in the education, or the inability to love yourself in the context of what it is, the information that you're getting and what it is that you're receiving. Like, it's on us. I don't put it on Vivek Ramaswamy. I don't think any Black community in the United States is counting on Donald Trump to come through for the educational experiences of their children, that the Donald Trump administration is going to be the one that transforms the educational experience of their child. I don't know of any Black families that believe that. I don't know of any families in Oakland that believe that somehow by dismantling the Department of Education on the federal level, that schools are going to get better in the towns and cities that we live in. I don't think anybody believes that they have the solution. I think the solutions have always come from our local engagement, from our commitment to our families in the community. There's schools like Ile Omide. There's programs like Kingmakers of Oakland. Strategies that are research informed, that are highly effective and have been effective for generations, but it's difficult for people to find those small diamonds in the rough, those tiny examples of high levels of excellence in the midst of like a sea of mediocrity. Sometimes it's hard to find the oasis, but as we have to either be the oasis or we have to find it. Right. But we can't depend on the same institutions that are poisoning the water, that are removing our histories, that are hiring people who don't have our interests at heart. We can't rely on them to take us to the next level.
I think you're making the point. And Dave, you can jump in on this. There's a school of thought, and I've heard this in the barbershops and other places. Maybe we need this pressure. Maybe we need this authoritarianism to show up, because what it's going to do, Hadari, what it's going to do, Dave Stavall, it's going to make us become innovative. It's going to make us come together. Look what they're doing in Florida, my brothers. You know, they took away Black history and the community got together and they're doing Black history classes on a Saturday. We need more of that. And this is what it's going to take. It's going to take a Donald Trump putting his foot on our neck. That's going to make us bring the best out.
I don't believe that. That's hype. That's hype.
But that's what people say.
But I was teaching public Black history classes when Obama was president. Like, it's not about who's president. Right. You know, we were running Young, Gifted, and Black. We've been Young and Gifted and Black for over 40 years. It's not about who's president. It's about us. It's about, like, what do we see for the future of our people, and what are we willing to do to achieve that future? What is it that we feel our young people need to know? And it's interesting because it's not just, you know, this conversation, a lot of this conversation is about technology and access to technology, but sometimes we don't acknowledge the things we lose in order to reach for those so-called achievements. So can we actually test our water? Like, can we actually grow food? Like, do we have are we teaching our young people a measure of independence that's more a reflection of our history in this country, more of a reflection of what our grandparents and great-grandparents needed to know than what we think we might need to know in the future about fixing a robot or understanding artificial intelligence? Like, for me, my children, I focus a lot on intelligence, not artificial intelligence, like actual intelligence, right? And if they have intelligence and they get that as a baseline, then they can explore these artificial realities and these other things. But you got to know reality to understand that the other one is augmented. You got to know the reality to understand that the other one is virtual. So it's about teaching reality.
Go ahead, Dave.
And what I'm hearing from Odari's points is you have to be clear around how we constantly support young folks. And we have never been educated in the United States because of its systems. We have always educated ourselves in spite of them. So I think we have to start with that point. And it's a question that I always ask, right? So when you say, can education happen in these places that we call schools, right? I mean, and that's not trying to put off a trick question, but to literally say, we know that this place, school, is more about order and compliance than it is about learning. It has proven to us historically that that's what it has been.
And so the response to that becomes, this is why we need to dismantle the schools. And we already know that the Dave DeValves and Hadari Davises of the world, they can educate these kids in spite of, and we just need to get more Dave DeValves and Hadaris to educate these kids. And then you got some middle class folks and others that are going, see, brother, we shouldn't even be in these places in the first place. We just need more community involvement, more of what you all do, and our kids are going to thrive in spite of. And I guess it becomes this argument, the Booker T versus W.E.D. Du Bois type of argument, where Booker T is like, let them do that thing. We're going to roll up our sleeves. We're going to work twice as hard, and we're going to, you know, maintain and do what we need to do. And Du Bois seemed to be challenging the notion of the system. Like, well, that's true. We can do all that, but we still should not ignore the inequality that is baked in to what we're dealing with. And I think that's kind of the conundrum that we're looking at, because somebody hearing you two talk would say, you're in Chicago and you have success, and you're in Oakland and you have success. So we should be able to replicate that left and right in spite of. In fact, let's take away more schools. Maybe more people will finally get on game and make it happen.
I think it's really important to put this, and this is, I really appreciate Hodari's point earlier, because this was the Obama hype. And I would always say this here in Chicago. Look, individual successes do not equate to collective victories, right? And I think we have
to repeat that again one more time.
Individual successes do not equate to collective victories. And I think we have to be clear about that, right? And I think one of the conundrums that you put forward, Davey, is important, because the vast majority of Black and brown youth are in what we refer to as public schools. Now, when we start to think about those spaces, what is the fugitive work to build cadre to do a couple of things? Because it's not just to make the institution better, but it's also to have the mechanisms of support that now can be inside of those spaces, and people who are in those spaces who understand the necessity of those external supports in that space. In fact, to the point that those external supports are the only way that those institutions do what's right by families, right? And I think, back to your earlier point, Davey, is this whole notion around, well, does this current moment of authoritarianism now put folks into motion? Only if we continue the work, right? So you have to be, people have to be able to see that there is something else, right? But you have to do that work, because if you don't, then the paralysis sets in, right? And people start to now accept this thing, which is completely unacceptable, as real and immutable, right? Unchangeable.
You lose hope.
The fugitive work really says, what are we willing to do? And to Hodari's point, how are we willing to pull from our ancestors' wisdom into the now to build something else, right? And I think that's the constant work. That's the constant tension that we have to grapple with in terms of what we're seeing and then what it is that we're doing.
What do you tell your kids in the classroom at this moment in time? you know, in spite of all the challenges that you're facing, no libraries in the schools in Chicago, you know, how many schools did they close? They closed like 50, you know, and 50. Really caused a lot of the problems that we see was the closing of those schools. We did entire shows. You're sitting in that classroom. What do you tell that Chicago school kid?
Well, I mean, I back to Hudari's point, I try to be deeply honest. It's like, look, given the history of the U.S. schooling system, me in this classroom actually gives you no good reason to trust me. So now, if we start with that, how do you all develop a mechanism to hold me to account and to develop a process where we can engage with each other based on the inquiries that we have about our world, now working with each other and other people in these spaces to change our reality? And that's where our education lies. Our education lies in our ability to ask questions of our world and being able to work with others to change it. And if at any point I have not done what I say I have intended to do, then it is on us to pull me back into that space so we can get that right. Right? I mean, just, and I think that's important. That's a day one conversation. Right. A lot of times people get into this as the developmental conversation. No, we have to start with that. To Odari's point, we want to be rooted and centered in reality. And if we are rooted and centered in reality, we have to start with what we are in. And then from there, we figure out what's what to move us into possibility.
Well, that starts with love. And a lot of people will come to our kids without that love, systemically and individually. And somebody would say, well, damn, you two as Black men are a rarity, just first of all, in the classroom, you know, for a lot of our kids. So that's one thing. And two, you come in there not teaching it, not taking it just as a job, but as a mission. Like, I'm here. Somebody else is doing it like, I just need a paycheck. They was going to take my student loans down if I started to do this teaching, but I don't really love these kids. I don't want to be in Chicago or Oakland teaching. And so we have that battle as well. Like, who's going to be talking to our kids? And, you know, I've been in a lot of classrooms. They don't say what you and Hudari say. You know, they're like, man, let them do whatever they need to do. As long as I get my check, I'm good. You know, and
yeah, I think that that's Davey, is what the culture of mediocrity is about.
Yeah.
And I think the conversation really started there with the role of capitalism in perpetuating mediocrity. Oh, I'm just here to get my check is a very mediocre way to approach education. And it's totally based on this capitalist idea that I show up to work and get paid no matter whether they fail or succeed. You know, NBA coaches get fired if they lose 15 games, but teachers could be bad for 15 years and still not lose their job. Principals and schools can turn out dropouts for 15 years and still hold on to their position. Superintendents get promoted. They get promoted. Apparently, they don't get the highest job in the country in education. If you want the highest job, you got to get into wrestling. You know, you got to be Linda McMahon or so. You got to be in the right. WWE if you want the highest job in education in America. But then we're going to complain about mediocrity. Like, literally elected a rapist and a felon who then hired the head of the WWE to be the head of the education system. And we're going to complain about mediocrity. Like, I don't think we can complain about mediocrity. I think that for our community, this conversation is a conversation we've been having a long time. And what I knew my ancestors to do is the same thing that I'm doing. It's the same thing that Dave did. We roll our sleeves up and we get in the faces of our young people and we do what we can to help transform their lives. We work with them to help transform their lives. I think something that Dave said that just reminded me of Freire so much. It's one of the reasons why Dave and I are like kindred spirits, but it reminded me of Freire so much. He's talking about rewriting our world, helping young people rewrite their realities, rewrite their world. Well, they have to be given a different education than the system that the United States is offering for them to do that. Because there's no test score that's going to measure your ability to rewrite your world. Like, when you're talking about transformation of our communities, transformation of the culture in our communities, and putting that in the hands of our young people who are very capable, who have incredible visions for the future, but they have to be activated and they have to be resourced. And it's often the lack of resource that leads to these other challenges. And, you know, it's interesting because we did Young Gifted and Black for no money. Like, we volunteered to do that for 10 years. Mm-hmm. These schools that are happening in Florida on the weekends, people aren't looking for a paycheck or wondering how they're going to get dues from families in order to pay for that, or looking for some nonprofit, who often the funders of the nonprofits are the same people we're talking about. Like, the funders of the nonprofits are still Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. It's their money that's in the philanthropy that's actually funding the nonprofit. So we have to get away from the systems that have within it a value, a benefit at keeping us at the lowest possible point in this caste system. Like, we have to empower ourselves. We have to figure out that we're not going to always get paid to do that work. It's not really about, it's not really about the money that we get or that type of compensation. It's about the love. You mentioned love. Like, love, you can't pay for my love. Like, you, my love is not for sale, right? I can't rent you my love 40 hours a week. Like, love is something that is not something that you can hourly put a dollar amount on. So if we're really about the love of our community, the love of these young people, the desire to have a real viable future, then we got to get beyond this. We got to get beyond the finances. We got to get beyond the money, and we got to get more, lean more into this concept, this idea of love.
Adari Davis, Dave Stavall, I want to get marching orders, and I'll start off with you, Dave. Two or three things that people listening should do, you know, as you give your last comment.
Definitely, no, appreciate it. I think one of the things that folks can really start to do is think about what questions are we trying to ask in relationship to what accounts for quality education? Second, get away from the performance metrics of test scores. They are arbitrary, and they only tell us how well a young person takes a test. Third, think about the ways. Who are the people who engage our young folks critically, who support their development of questions and the asking of questions, and now how to figure out how to support them? They will need support in the most serious of ways in the next day, in the days and months ahead. Because those are the folks who will be first targeted in this moment. So now we need to figure out who those folks are. And parents do this pretty well in terms of when they know a good teacher, they know them off the top. And now we have to think about what are the ways in which we support them.
And that's the gaslighting. They see a Dave Stavall in a place like Texas or Florida teaching the way that you teach. And they're saying, yeah, our kids are mediocre, but they'll pull you out the classroom first. Talking about that, you know, you made some white kid feel uncomfortable because you talked about some reality in history, and that's going to be a challenge. And yeah, you see that across the board. Good teachers are being targeted and will have that target on the back while simultaneously we're telling people that they're mediocre. You know, so that's something that we're going to have to look out for, and we appreciate you. Hadari, we got 30 seconds. Marching orders you want to give anybody?
Yeah, I just think that innovation doesn't start in the classroom. I think innovation starts in the home. I think good education starts in the home. So really practical things like read to your children, find books that are going to empower young people to feel good about themselves, and read to them. Don't just always put it on them to read to you. I think reading to children is important. I think early childhood education, whatever emphasis we can place on our toddlers and our babies learning and getting as much knowledge as possible, is super important and super critical to our long-term future. And then third, I'm going to just say that we have to get beyond money for education. Like, we as a community have to get back to education for education's sake. We have to get back to reading and literacy and art for the sake of the advancement of our people and not for filling pocketbooks. There may not be a job at the other end of being an incredible reader unless you make it, because that's what it's about for our community now. It's about making our way, and education is one tool to make that happen.
What would you say for the parents that have older kids, teenagers?
I would say get books. I would say read to them. I would say listen to what they're listening to. I would say encourage them to use language in complex ways. I would say help them to write down their dreams and envision the future that they want to see, and work with them on making those futures a reality. Like, this technology and the whole focus on creating alternative worlds, there's a lot of emphasis on new augmented worlds, new virtual worlds, new realities that haven't existed before. But that's not much different than us reimagining our own reality. That's not too far away from us thinking, how can we solve this lead in the water problem? Are there classes, teachers, educators actually focused on that? Like, are these young people, do they even know that drinking out of the water is poisoning their bodies? Do their families know? Do their parents know? How do we engage young people in the ability to test their water, in the ability to change their pipes? Like, we get often so caught up in the virtual conversation, and in even the conversation that Vivek Ramaswamy is promoting is, you know, number one in the world in global education is Shanghai, China. Number two is Singapore. Third is Hong Kong. Fourth is Taiwan. Fifth is South Korea. Like, come on, that's not Oakland. Like, those communities and the education that they have, their math scores, their English scores, they're not going to solve our lead problem. Like, who's going to solve our lead problem? We're going to solve our lead problem. Our young people are going to have to solve our lead problem. We're going to have to roll our sleeves up and learn how it works. And this is what I mean by education for practical purposes, not just education for this fantastic notion that one day I too can be Vivek Ramaswamy. And I think that's what they're leading with, that you too one day can be one of the billionaires, and then you can actually work in the Trump administration. Like, stop right now. Let's just make sure that grandma lives to like 80. Let's make sure that these young babies can read by the time that they enter school. Like, these are the things that we can do. These are very practical things. And even our young people, even our teenagers who are reading at the eighth grade level or the sixth grade level, they can still help these preschoolers learn how to read and write. So I just feel like we need to reorganize our own priorities around the challenges that exist in our world, and not the challenges that exist in some world that we've never seen, never experienced, and may never even be able to afford.
Adari Davis, educator, young, gifted, and Black, we appreciate you. And Dave Staval, educator, extraordinaire out of Chicago, we appreciate you. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Americans are dumb. Really, really dumb. Racist systems got her numb. Americans are doomed. Hate's been ingrained, it's where we're from. They voted for hate, thought they'd win it all, but now they're feeling small as they watch it fall. They backed the rich man, the one full of pride. Now they're called mediocre, nowhere to hide. Americans are dumb. Really, really dumb. Racist systems got her numb. Americans are too really dumb. They split and brain, that's where we're from.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. I was in a maritime museum in Rotterdam a few weeks ago, listening to esteemed colleagues narrate their accomplishments and dreams. I drifted off. To the side, there was a panel of fancy rope work and an intricacy of knots. What's in a knot? I looked it up, and was gone into my own dream world of words and the ironies and relevancies of many definitions. A knot is an interlacement of the parts of one or more flexible bodies, a lump or knot so formed, a tight constriction, something hard to solve, a bond of union, a protuberant lump or swelling in tissues, the base of a woody branch enclosed in the stem from which it arises, a cluster of person or things, an ornamental bow of ribbon, a division of the log's line serving to measure a ship's speed, 1 nautical mile, a closed curve in 3-dimensional space. There is a progression of meaning in the list, from the central definition, which implies both a noun and a verb, a thing and an action. The lump, so formed, is an elegant thing, even a sculpture, entwining constricted forms in an imagined utilitarian form. A knot is a problem. A knot is a bond. A knot is a union of line, form, and relation. A knot is an emotional bond. It embodies a fixing, a complicated practicality and unity. A knot is a function of nature. A knot is the work of an imagination, at once an evocation of beauty and community, and a measure of interval, speed, and distance. A knot is a closed curve in a 3-dimensional space. My colleagues in presentation carried on so many iterations and connections. As a closed curve myself, living in 3 dimensions, am I a knot as well? It was only a neurological jump from these thoughts to the larger, obvious metaphor, the ocean. Surely the ocean is a curved space in 3 dimensions. Within its fluid state, it is a dynamic of knots, as navigational vectors, circulating currents, schools of fish entangled, the cutting edges of diving turns. Surely the ocean is an interplacement of one or more ornamental flexible bodies, certainly a cluster of persons or things. The ocean is a world knot, an arc in the shape of the horizon, the curl of a wave, the turn of a whale sounding. A knot is an ultimate device, a response to a specific challenge tied with the integrity and experience and authenticity of knowledge. A knot is a tool by which we meet challenges and solve problems. A knot is a tie that binds, like the sea, escape for connection. I was distracted by a round of applause. The colleague took questions. She was smart, earnest, and ambitious. Good, I thought. She was the next generation of the curators and historians who will endeavor to interpret and explain the history of knots as evocations of the human imagination and cultural exchange. Suddenly it all seemed untied and explicable to me. Did I cry out, Eureka, or did I stand up with the audience to stretch and get in line for coffee? We will discuss these things and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org, where the full catalog is searchable by theme. Thanks for listening.
I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Each week here on WERU Community Radio, Blue Hill, Maine, every Wednesday morning, I host World Ocean Radio, a 5-minute feature that surveys the impact of the ocean far and wide on every level of our being, freshwater, food, health, trade, transportation, policy, governance, finance, community development, and cultural traditions. The ocean is climate, and the sea connects all things. Please join me every Wednesday at 8:30 a.m. on Morning Main, here on WERU Radio.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication